Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahanao Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Katakshakirana Chanta Naman Mohabdaye Namaha. Ananta Nanda Krishnaya Jagan Mangala Murtaye. Om. Welcome back. That looks good. Welcome to the webcast of our Tuesday evening Vedanta class on Advaita Makaranda. And we are going to continue today with verse 4. Let's chant the verse, and then I have some introduction before we see the details. Repeat after me. Nasvata pratyabhijnanan, nasvata pratyabhijnanan, niram shatva nachanyataha, niram shatva nachanyataha, nachashrayavinashan me. Nachashraya vinashan me, vinashasyara nashrayata, vinashasyara nashrayata. Na me, vinashaha vinasha. And that last line. Our manana and nididhyasana continues. Manana during class, nididhyasana when you reflect on these verses at home. Our manana continues now with a particular inquiry, a very detailed inquiry in this verse, with regard to the nature of sat. Atma is sat, chit, ananda. Chit, consciousness. That is ananda, full, complete, limitless, perfect, divine, untouched by worldly suffering. And that chit, ananda, is sat. And we have a very, you know, sat, I have to say, when Satchitananda is simply translated as existence, consciousness, bliss, when I see that translation, I want to cringe. First of all, we've discussed at length how ananda is not a suitable word. Bliss is not a suitable translation for ananda, since the word bliss gives the idea of an experience. So when Satchitananda is translated existence, consciousness, bliss, consciousness is all right. Bliss makes me cringe, and existence is very vague. So not just existence in what sense? Fundamental existence, the ground of reality, that because of which everything exists, that which is absolutely real. And remember, we had a very precise definition for that which is real. Trikala abaditam, that which is abadita, non-negatable in trikala, in the three periods of time, in the past, in the present, in the future. So non-negatable in the past means unborn, uncreated. Non-negatable in the present means unchanging. And non-negatable in the future means not subject to death or destruction. And that destruction is what this verse is dealing with. How do we know for sure, if we can say that? How can we be absolutely certain that Atma is not subject to destruction? We have a lot of scriptural statements which say Atma is unborn, eternal, unchanging, and therefore indestructible. But we, in addition to scripture, we use a lot of reasoning to establish the fact that Atma is not subject to destruction. And in this verse, our author, Lakshmidhara Kavi, gives three kinds of reasoning to establish the absence of destruction for Atma. And it's really actually quite, I like it. It's really quite insightful. He gives three possible kinds of destruction. Let me go to the board and show you those three possible kinds of destruction. The word we're going to use for destruction is nasha. Let me use more common transliteration. Nasha means destruction. And here, he's going to discuss three different kinds of destruction that could affect Atma, and then all three will be negated in this verse. The first kind of nasha or destruction, the word he uses is swataha, which literally means by oneself. Self-destruction. Can Atma undergo self-destruction? That seems like very odd, very abstract. But a good example of self-destruction is the destruction of the rope snake. How does that snake get destroyed? It destroys, it goes away. When ignorance, let me put it another way. I'm going to get in trouble depending on my explanation here. That snake just goes away when the rope is known. You don't have to beat the snake with a stick to kill the snake and make it go away. It goes away on its own as soon as the rope is known. So that would be an example of swata nasha, self-destruction. Swata nasha, self-destruction. We're going to see each of these three in the verse. We'll just identify them first. The second one is anyataha. Anya is other. Anyataha is destruction due to another. So destruction due to another. And the example the commentator gives is if you have a clay pot and you break that pot with a stick. To use a stick to break the pot. That stick is anya, other. So to use a stick to break the pot is anyataha nasha. It is destruction, nasha, which is anyataha, due to another, in this case due to the stick. And the third kind of destruction that we'll be discussing in this verse is ashraya nasha. Ashraya means substratum. So the destruction of a substratum. I know that sounds very abstract. The commentator gives a nice example. Suppose you have a painting on a piece of cloth. If you have a painting on a piece of cloth, like a beautiful landscape painting. If you destroy the cloth, the painting, the landscape goes away. The landscape is a painting upon the cloth. The cloth is the ashraya. When there is ashraya nasha, the destruction of the underlying reality, in this case cloth, when the cloth goes away, that painting, the beautiful landscape, goes away. So these are the three kinds of nasha that are going to be considered in this verse in the process of our ongoing manana. Let me sit down and we'll continue.
So, now coming to our verse.
The last word of the third line, may, for me. Remember we said this whole text is in the first person. So me, for me, for me, means for my true nature, for Atma, for Satchidananda Atma. May, for me, for Satchidananda Atma, na vinashaha syat. Vinashaha, destruction, na syat, is not possible. There is no possibility of destruction, may, for me. Now we're going to, in the verse, he's going to consider the three kinds of possible destruction and show why each of those three are not possible. So first we begin with swataha nashaha. Look at the first line. Na swataha na vinashaha. You could connect those first two words, na swataha, and connect it down below. Na swataha vinashaha syat. There is no self-destruction possible, may, for me. There's no destruction of Atma on its own accord. Why? Pratyabhijnanat. Pratyabhijnana means recognition. Pratyabhijnanat, that final ta becomes na, due to some grammar rules. So pratyabhijnanat, due to self-recognition, there is no self-destruction for Atma. I've given you a literal translation, and it's almost meaningless. This is so dense, so terse. This being an advanced text, the author speaks almost in sutras, in very cryptic, small little statements. So we need to unpack this very carefully. The use of the word pratyabhijnana here is often used in response to our Buddhist friends. Our Buddhist friends who say that Atma, they don't use the word Atma, they'll say, we'll call it self. They say, our Buddhist friends say, that Atma is subject to destruction. And Atma is, again, they don't use the word Atma, I keep falling back to that, self, we'll use the English word self. They say, self is subject to destruction. Why? Because they say, self is illusion. Self is illusion. That's a very interesting contrast to Hinduism in general and Vedanta in particular, which says self is divine. Compare those two traditions. Hinduism saying the self is divine, Buddhism saying the self is illusory, false. How can we reconcile the two? It would be overly simplistic to say, oh, Hinduism is right and Buddhism is wrong. We never say that. It's unnecessary to say that. Buddhism is correct from its own standpoint. And its standpoint has to do with its definition of self. So the way Buddhism defines self and the way Vedanta defines self are utterly different. So in Vedanta, we understand self to be Satchidananda Atma, that unchanging, unborn, uncreated, limitless consciousness. Buddhism doesn't accept the existence of that Atma. When the Buddhist talks about self, he's talking about the individual being, which is an assemblage of parts. They use the term skanda, different skandas, different parts. So body, mind, and senses, all of these pieces put together with this ego, this ahankara, the sense of individuality. When you put all the pieces together, you end up with a self. Now that's a little bit like when you put all the pieces of a car together, you end up with a car. But that car that you put together is subject to destruction if you take away all the parts. The car is subject to self-destruction when you take away all the parts. And in Buddhism, a self, which is not our Vedantic self, the Buddhist self, which is composed of all these skandhas, all these parts, body, mind, senses, and ego, that Buddhist self being composed of parts is subject to self-destruction when the parts are removed. Just like the rope snake is subject to self-destruction, in the same way the Buddhist self is subject to self-destruction. Not the Vedantic self, not Atma. Why? And here the reason is given, pratyabhijñānāt. Due to pratyabhijñāna, due to self-recognition, we establish that consciousness doesn't itself get destroyed, doesn't go away, doesn't come and go, doesn't blink on and off. We've had this discussion before, that consciousness is unchanging, unwavering, absolutely steady, which means when you're conscious now, consciousness is present in your experience right now, the very same consciousness is present when you dream. And then when you fall into dreamless sleep, the very same consciousness is present in dreamless sleep. We established that in some length in a prior class here, and an even greater length in our Atma Bodha classes, so I won't go into all that again. In deep sleep, you are as conscious as you are now. Only difference is, in deep sleep, there's nothing to be conscious of. The metaphor I gave is like standing in a dark closet with your eyes wide open. In that perfectly dark closet with your eyes wide open, you see. You haven't lost your eyesight. You see, but there's nothing to be seen. In the same way, in deep sleep, you're conscious, fully conscious, but there's nothing to be conscious of. Then, when you wake up, out of deep sleep, you're now conscious of this waking state. Consider this. We want to come to this word, pratyabhijñāna, self-recognition. When you wake up, the conscious person who wakes up, are you the same or different from the conscious person who was dreaming and from the conscious person who was in deep sleep? When you wake up, you recognize that you are the same consciousness who was present in the dream state, the same consciousness who was present in the darkness of deep sleep, the very same consciousness is present right now in the waking state when you wake up. That is pratyabhijñāna, self-recognition, that you are the same conscious being in waking, dream, and sleep. Or another example, when you were an infant, you had so many experiences. We don't remember those infant experiences, right? But those infant experiences were known to you, were experienced by you. So here's the question. The consciousness by which your infant experiences were known, the consciousness by which your childhood experiences were known, the consciousness by which your teenage experiences are known, the consciousness by which your young adult experiences were known, the consciousness by which experiences in each phase of your life were known, is that one consciousness or many different ones? One unchanging consciousness. From day to day, when you wake up from your dreams, when you wake up from deep sleep, you have this pratyabhijñāna, this recognition. I am the same consciousness. And you have that same recognition each year. You have a birthday. After your birthday, you're not a different person. You are the same conscious person. Atma has no birthday. Atma was never born. Atma doesn't age. Atma is not subject to nasha, to destruction. So here's the first of the three kinds of nasha, destruction, which is negated here. Na swataha nashaha syat. There is no possibility for the self-destruction of Atma. Why? Pratyabhijñānāt. Because of this recognition, I am the same consciousness in waking, dream, and sleep. I am the same consciousness in childhood, youth, and old age. That self-recognition is always there. That's the first of the three kinds of nasha. The second, in the second line, niramsha twat na cha anyataha. And we have to break all the words apart. Na cha and anyataha, that's the second of our three. Remember? There we go. So the second of the three kinds of destruction, anyataha, destruction due to another, like a pot being broken by a stick. It says here, anyataha, destruction due to something else, na vinashaha syat, is not possible. May, at the end of the third line, for me. There is no possibility of destruction of me, of consciousness, of Atma, anyataha, due to something else. So a stick is different from a pot, and that stick can break the pot. It says here, though, there is no destruction due to something else, and the reason he gives is niramshatvat. Because of the state, because of Atma's nature being niramsha. Amsha, you might know, is a part. Niramsha, part. Lists. That which has parts is subject to destruction. This is some logic that you may not have considered before, but it's a little important. I gave the example of an automobile, a car, which is made of all kinds of parts. Anything made of parts is subject to destruction because anything made of parts can fall apart. Obviously, a car is made of parts. It can fall apart. It's subject to destruction. Your body is made of parts. We know this very well, that it's subject to destruction. Your senses, your prana, even the aspects of your mind, it all consists of parts. We could even consider those parts the elements, five elements or 104, whatever number of elements there are in modern science. Anything made of elements, anything made of parts, is subject to destruction. It can fall apart when acted upon by something else. So that the pot can be acted upon by a stick and broken into shards. So the pot has parts, shards. When the pot is acted upon with the stick, it's broken into parts. That car can be acted upon by parts, by tools, screwdrivers, hammers, saws, etc. You can use these tools to take the car apart. That which is made of parts can be disassembled or broken. Atma, consciousness, has how many parts? Come to your own experience. The consciousness, which is your essential nature, the consciousness which is present here and now in this experience, as we're having this class, how many parts does your consciousness have Well, our own experience says that consciousness is partless, seamless, undivided. That which has no parts is indestructible. It cannot be acted upon anyataha by something else. It can't be reduced into smaller parts by being acted upon anyataha by something else. Next verse is going to talk about this one in much more detail. So this second of the two kinds of destruction, anyataha nasha, will be described in much more detail in the next verse. So we'll leave it here. And we'll proceed now to the third kind of destruction, which is ashraya nasha, the destruction of the substratum, like the cloth on which a painting is made. The cloth is destroyed, the landscape painted on that cloth also gets destroyed. Is that possible for Atma? That the substratum, ashraya, you see in the third line, nacha ashraya vinashat. Ashraya is substratum, foundation, the underlying basis for something's existence. So it says here, na, putting the words together, cha, and na me vinashaha syat. There is no destruction for me, for consciousness, for Atma, ashraya vinashat, due to the vinasha, the destruction of ashraya. Now, that which has an ashraya, an underlying reality, can be destroyed. That landscape painting can be destroyed because it's painted on cloth. This pot can be destroyed because it's made of clay. That which exists depending on something else is subject to destruction. This pot exists dependent on clay. Therefore, this pot is subject to destruction by removing the clay. If you subtract the clay, there's no pot. If you remove or destroy the cloth, there's no painting. What about for Atma? For your body has an underlying reality. That reality can be removed. The body can be destroyed. Mind can be destroyed. Anything that has an underlying reality can be destroyed. Your consciousness exists dependent on what underlying reality? There is no underlying reality because of which consciousness exists. We would say that consciousness is a fundamental reality and not a dependent reality. In this example, clay is a fundamental reality. Yes, we know it's made of elements, etc., but that's not our metaphor. Staying within the metaphor, clay, relative to the pot, clay is a fundamental reality. Pot, on the other hand, is not a fundamental reality. It's a dependent reality. Remember the words we've used? Dependent reality, mithya. Independent reality or fundamental reality, satyam. So relative to the pot, which is a dependent reality, mithya, clay, relatively speaking, is satyam, an independent reality, a fundamental reality. If the pot is broken, nothing happens to the clay, because a clay is an entirely different kind of reality, a fundamental reality. And whereas the clay exists dependent on pot, just as the pot exists dependent on clay, the clay in this metaphor doesn't depend on anything else in the metaphor. Please don't tell me, but Swamiji, the clay is made of atoms. That's going outside of the metaphor. So stay inside the metaphor. So pot exists dependent upon an ashraya. The ashraya is clay. Get rid of the ashraya, you get rid of the pot. Atma is not dependent on any ashraya. Like the clay in our metaphor is an independent and fundamental reality in the same way. Consciousness is a fundamental reality. It exists dependent on nothing else, therefore. It is not subject to ashraya nasha. So in this verse, for the sake of manana, our author has detailed these three kinds of nasha: swata nasha, self-destruction; anyataha nasha, destruction due to something else; and ashraya nasha, destruction of a substratum. And as part of our process of manana, each one of these possibilities is removed. That's what manana is about. In fact, I haven't given this example before. A classical example of manana. You may not have had these three doubts. This idea of swata nasha, self-destruction, you may never have considered that. Anyataha nasha kind of makes more sense. Ashraya vinasha, you may not have thought about it. So here, our author is introducing kinds of destruction you've never even considered, never even thought about. Then why is he introducing these doubts, introducing doubts you haven't even had? This is so typical of manana. And it's described, the process of manana is described this with this wonderful metaphor. I should have given this before. I'm surprised I didn't. It's the classical image, metaphor, drishtanta, for manana. Suppose you are building a fence. And of course, the first step of putting in a fence is putting in fence posts. So you dig a hole, you have a big piece of wood, you put the fence post in the hole, and then you fill all the dirt back into that hole. And now you have a erect fence post. Of course, that fence post isn't very secure. If you take that fence post with your hands, you can wiggle it, wobble it. You can make it move. Well, you need a fence post that doesn't move. So how do you do that? Well, when you move the fence post back and forth, you create some space in the ground. You can fill in more dirt. So suppose you wiggle the fence post and then pack in some more dirt. It's a little bit more stable. But then suppose you wiggle it some more and pack in more dirt. And wiggle it some more and pack in yet more dirt. Each time you wiggle it, it moves a little bit less, and each time you pack in more dirt, it becomes more stable, it becomes stronger, more fixed in the ground. This process really very nicely describes the process of manana. Here we are engaged in the process of raising doubts and dismissing them. That process of raising doubts and dismissing them is represented by wiggling the fence post and then packing in more dirt. The more you wiggle the fence post and the more dirt you pack in, the stronger that fence post becomes. The more we raise doubts and dismiss them, the stronger our understanding becomes, the less susceptible we become to any kind of doubt or vagueness. Now, there's an important point we'll make here, and that is, I struggled with this quite a bit, and fact, I think in a prior class I made a reference to this also. And the concern was, actually, I may not have. Let me just say, when I was a young student during our three-year course, every day I had lots of questions. Swami Dayananda was teaching us every day. We had four classes a day, three classes plus satsang with him every day. It'd be an early morning class, usually Upanishad. Then there'd be a mid-morning class, maybe a text of Shankara. There'd be an evening class, usually Bhagavad Gita. And then after dinner, there would always be satsang. Well, every day in satsang, I had a new list of questions. God, he was so patient because every single day I had more questions for him. This went on for 3 years. Our course was a three-year course, and I keep coming up with questions. Unfortunately, he was patient and ready to handle all of my questions. But at one point, I got very concerned towards the end of the course. And that is, when will my questions come to an end? When will my last doubt be addressed? You can see the problem? Why should there be a last doubt? Our minds, I'll speak for myself anyway, my mind is so convoluted that it can always create a doubt. Is this, you make a doubt of anything. Is this really up? Maybe it's not up. Maybe my head is crooked. I'm just being silly to make a point. Anything can be doubted. And the more powerful your mind is, the more doubts you can create. And this was my dilemma. It seemed like my mind was so powerful, not that it's anything special, my mind was so inclined to come up with more and more doubts. I wondered if my understanding of my true nature, Satchidananda Atma, I wondered if that understanding would ever be doubt-free. When would my last doubt be addressed? So I had that doubt. I went to Swami Dayananda, actually in private. He allowed us to meet with him privately. And sometimes these more personal or more intense questions were better dealt with him on a one-to-one basis in a private meeting. So I met with him privately and I described my concern. Swamiji, when will my doubts come to an end? When will my understanding no longer be impeded by all these doubts? He helped me understand something very important, and that was that whatever doubt my mind can conjure up, those doubts that I invent are certainly nothing that hasn't been considered before. Whatever doubts I have and will have, all of these doubts have already been entertained by other people and by people much smarter than me. So if doubts in the minds of people who were much smarter than me have already been handled in the teachings and commentaries on Advaita Vedanta, then what is the possibility of me coming up with a doubt so radical, so novel that no one has ever thought about it before? It could be the weak link in Vedanta. My gosh, how arrogant it would be for me to think that I could come up with such a doubt. There are people much smarter than me who have already gone through all these teachings and looked with a magnifying glass, looking for any weak points in these teachings. It's all been handled thoroughly before. The answers are there. So what I learned, what Pujya Swamiji helped me understand, is that for any doubts I may have in the future, the answers are already there. I may have to look for them. If while I was there in a 3-year course with Pujya Swamiji, if I had a doubt, I could instantly get an answer. In future years, when I was no longer with him, if I had a doubt, I could either wait and contact him at a future time, or what I learned to do was to figure out the doubts for myself. There's so much in the commentaries on all of our texts. I learned that the answers are all there. And that led me to a very interesting change of attitude towards my doubts. I used to be afraid that one day I would have a doubt. I would discover that weak link in the teachings of Vedanta. And that bothered me for a long time, that one day I would have that particular doubt. And that concern went away entirely, which means any doubt that comes up in my mind no longer bothers me. I know I can handle it. I can find the answer to that doubt in the teachings, or I need not. I can just say, okay, it's another another doubt. It's nothing that can challenge the strength of these teachings. Imagine that fence post has been wiggled and strengthened for a couple thousand years now by how many generations of students and teachers. It is absolutely firm. It is unshakable. That's what I came to understand. Okay. The next verse is closely related. We will see that. Repeat after me. Nashosha plosha vikleda. Nashosha plosha vikleda. Chedash chinnabaso mama. Chedash chinnabaso mama. Satyarapyanilagnyam baha. Satyarapyanilagnyam baha. Shastrayar kemuta kalpitaihi. Shastrayar kemuta kalpitaihi. Nice. In the second line, mama, for me, for consciousness, for my true self, Atma, there is na, in the first line, na shoshaha, no drying of my true self. And if you see in the third line, anila, oh, the words are all, what a mess. Sat in the third line, satyaihi api anila agni ambas. My gosh, all of that run together. Satyaihi api anila agni and ambaha. Anila is air, agni fire, amba water. We're getting an analysis of elements, and this analysis is dealing with that second of the three possible kinds of destruction, destruction by something else. So the question here is, mama, for me, for consciousness, for Atma, is there any way of affecting it by, in the third line, by anila, water, air? So air can dry out like a leaf or fruit. A leaf can be dried up, desiccated. A fruit can certainly be dried up, anila, by wind. But mama, for me, there is na shoshaha. There is no possibility of drying. Do you know what? I want to back off because there's a metaphor that's in this verse. If we see the metaphor first, this will make so much more sense. I apologize, I'm taking things not... In fact, if you see my scribbles, I actually have an order in which I want to take these particular parts, and I didn't follow my own order. So let me come back to the order. And I want to start by looking in the second line at the expression chinnabasaha mama. Mama, for me. For me, who is chit. You're breaking apart the words. Oh, another mess. Chedaha chit nabasaha mama. Breaking the words in the third, in the second line. Chedaha chit nabasaha mama. Mama, for me. For me, who is chit nabhas. Nabhas is a word for space. Chit, you know, is consciousness. Chit nabhas, the space of consciousness. A more common expression is chit akasha. Akasha, of course, is space. So chit chin nabhas, the space of consciousness. Chit akasha, the space of consciousness. And this is a metaphor. Space is not consciousness. Space is one of the five fundamental elements. But in the expression chidakasha or chinnabhas, in those expressions, consciousness is compared to space. There's some similarities between consciousness and space. For example, how many parts does space have? Now, if you start to think, well, there's space inside this room, there's space outside this room, but you know very well that the walls that divide this room don't really divide space, just as the space inside this pot and the space outside this pot are not two different spaces. There is one space. So instead of saying there's space in the pot and outside the pot, it's so much more accurate, as we've said before. It's not space in the pot, it's pot in space. It's not that space is in the pot, pot is in space. It's not that space is in the room is in space. And that space in which this pot exists, space in which this room exists, that space has no parts, no divisions. The commentator says, nir avayava, partless. Space is partless. Consciousness, as we've just discussed in the prior verse, partless. So consciousness is compared to space because just like space has no parts, no divisions, in the same way consciousness has no parts or divisions. Also, space is nirakara. Space has no form. Now, you can talk of a pot space, but that pot space is only due to the presence of pot. Really speaking, space in and of itself is formless, nirakara. And just as space has no form, in the same way, consciousness has no form. Finally, space is utterly unaffected by anything. So when there is smoke in the air, how does that smoke affect space? It affects air. Smoke in the sense of pollution. Pollution absolutely affects the air we breathe. It affects it very badly. But that pollution and smoke in the air doesn't affect space itself. So space is, the word that's used is asanga. Asanga, not connected, but in this context, not affected by anything. So space is niravayava, partless, like consciousness is niravayava, partless. Space is nirakara, formless. Consciousness is nirakara, formless. And space is asangaha, utterly unaffected by whatever is in the space, and in the same way, consciousness is asangaha, utterly unaffected by anything and everything. And it's that last one, consciousness being asangaha, unaffected by anything. So look at this. Space is one of the four elements. And this is the introduction I should have given before. Space is one of the four elements, so we have to ask, can it be affected by the other four elements? Can it be affected by, to use the words in the third line, can it be affected by anila, wind? Does the wind that blows through space, does it affect space? So that anila, that wind, can dry out a leaf or fruit, the word shosha in the first line. That wind can cause the shoshana, the drying out of a leaf or fruit, but wind cannot affect space. Wind blows through space without affecting it at all. In the same way, can Atma be affected by wind? The wind that can dry out a leaf or fruit, that wind cannot affect consciousness, Atma. Then, what about Agni? In the third line, the wind words are all run together. Anila, Agni, Ambaha, breaking the words apart. So can Agni, the next of our elements, can Agni affect space, fire? Well, fire can burn things. Fire can burn cloth. Fire can't burn space. Fire, space being asanga, absolutely unaffected. So in the first line, it says, na ploshaha. There is no plosha burning. Plosha, dahana is more common. Plosha here means burning. So for space, there is na ploshaha, no burning of space due to agni, fire. Similarly, there's no burning of consciousness due to fire. Again, consciousness being asanga, like space is unaffected, consciousness is asanga, unaffected. Then what about end of the third line, ambas, water? Can space be affected? Can space be made wet by water? In a farmer's field, grain can be destroyed by water. Interesting. The farmer needs water, but if that rain comes at the wrong time, that rain can actually destroy his crops. So that water can cause destruction of the grains growing in the fields. Can that umbus, can that water, end of the first line, can it cause kleda, wetness which can cause destruction? Can that water cause kleda, dampening, wetting of space? No, space isn't affected at all by water. So if space can't be affected by water, then how can consciousness be affected by water? This is the argument. If wind can't affect space, how can it possibly affect Atma? If fire can't burn space, let me back up. If wind can't dry out space, then how could that wind possibly harm or destroy consciousness? If Agni, fire, can't burn space, how could that fire possibly burn or destroy consciousness, Atma? Ambas, water. If water can't damage space in any way whatsoever, how could that water cause kledaha, dampening or wetness, or any kind of effect for consciousness, for Atma? And then the last of our elements, prithivi, but prithivi, earth. How about prithivi in the form of a shastra? Look at the fourth line. Shastra, weapon. So elements, prithivi, earth, in the form of, say, steel, in the form of of a sword, shastra, a weapon. So can prithivi, earth, shastraihi, in the form of a sword, can it cause, and end the first line, by the way, the Sanskrit here is very elegant. He's strung this all together. Well, if there's time, I'll talk about it. Not necessary also. Can that steel sword cause second line, cheda, cutting? That steel sword can certainly cut something like sugar cane, but that steel sword, can it cut space? Obviously not. Well, the point here is, if that shastra, that steel sword, if it can't cause the cheda, the cutting of space, then how can it cause the cutting of atma, consciousness? So the first part of this verse says that for air, fire, water, and earth, just as they cannot, and anything made of these four elements, anything made of elements of these four elements can't affect space. And since space, and why? Because space is niravayava, has no parts. Space is nirakara, it's formless. And space is asanga, unaffected by anything. Since anything made of these four elements can't affect space because of its nature, atma shares that nature. Atma is also niravayava, partless. Atma is also nirakara, formless. Atma is also asanga, unaffected. Therefore, atma can similarly not be affected by any of these four elements. By the way, just mention very quickly for our Sanskrit students, our author here is very clever in putting these words together and maintaining order. So in the first line, he has the correct order. Start in the third line. In the third line, the order he has is anila, air, agni, fire, ambas, water, and shastra, a weapon made of prithivi. And notice it follows the same order as the first line. So anila, air can't cause the shosha, drying. Agni can't cause the plosha, burning. Ambas, water, can't cause the kleda, wetting. And shastra, made of elements, made of earth, can't cause the cheda, cutting. And believe me, these verses have to be composed in a meter which has just eight syllables and a quarter and a certain pattern of short and long syllables. For our author to compose this verse, keeping the order correct and still managing to follow the rules of these verses, our author has done a minor miracle in composing this verse. Anyway, if those of you who know some Sanskrit, hopefully you can appreciate the feat our author has performed here. And he's not done. Before I finish the verse, though, does this sound a little familiar to you? Atma can't be dried, can't be burnt, can't be wet, can't be cut. Aced yo yamadah yo yam, aklad yo shosha hevacha. Exactly the same teaching in the Bhagavad Gita. This is verse 24, chapter 2, verse 24, but in reverse order. So in the Bhagavad Gita, aced yaha ayam. I am Atma. This self is achedyaha, that came last here. Atma is adahyaha, unburnable. Atma is akledaha, unwettable. Atma is ashoshyaha, not dryable. So exactly the same adjectives, but in reverse order. And no doubt our author was inspired by this verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Now, this verse ends with a surprising twist. So let me explain the twist, and then I'll show you the last line. So here's the twist. The four elements of air, fire, water, and earth, those four elements are as real as space, and even though they all have the same level of reality, vyavaharika satta, one is as real as another. Earth is as real as water, which is as real as fire, which is as real as air, which is as real as space. And here the point is, even though those four elements are as real as space, anything made of those four elements can't affect space, because space has this unique quality, has no parts, has no form, and is utterly unaffected. So now our author is going to make a point, and he says in the third line, satyaihi api, even though space can't be affected by these four elements, air, fire, water, and earth, even though space can't be affected by these four elements, which are satya, which are real, satyaihi, by them, even though space can't be affected by these four elements, which are as real as space, he says, kimuta, it's an idiom, then what to speak of kalpitaihi, those things which are imagined. Kalpita, imagined. Here's the point. If space can't be affected by real wind, then how could space be affected by imaginary wind? If space can't be affected by real fire, what to speak of imaginary fire, or imaginary water, or imaginary swords? And the point he's making here is Atma, consciousness, is more real than these four elements. Space is as real as the four elements. Therefore, space, and yet space cannot be affected by anything made of the four elements. So you could say that Atma too can't be affected by anything made of the four elements. But look at this, he says at the end, but Atma is more real than the four elements. Anything made of the four elements is not as real as consciousness, as Atma. So therefore, it's even more impossible. It's already impossible for anything made of the four elements to affect Atma, but it's even more impossible for anything made of the four elements to affect Atma, because the elements are not as real as Atma. In a dream sword can't affect your real body. A dream water can't drench your real body. Dream fire can't burn your real body. And dream air can't dry out your real body. The point is, anything that's in a dream is not as real as your waking self, therefore absolutely has no possibility of affecting it. So here our author is saying, look at this, if real elements can't affect space, and real elements can't affect Atma in the same way as they can't affect space, consider the fact that these elements are not as real as consciousness. And if elements are not as real as consciousness, then in a second way, anything made of elements is absolutely incapable of affecting consciousness. The bottom line here is asangaha chirakasha. Your consciousness, the consciousness present right now in this experience, can't be affected by anything outside in the world, by anything that happens in your mind, can't be affected by anything whatsoever. That consciousness remains limitless, full, complete, no matter what, in all situations, in all conditions. This is understood first through Scripture, and then it is understood further through this process of manana. So through the manana we've just completed, we remove any possibility of imagining that your consciousness can be harmed in any way by anything outside in the world, by anything inside your mind. Your consciousness remains absolutely pure, unperturbed in any and all situations. Good. We'll conclude here. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah, Sarve Santu Niramayah, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet, Asato Ma Satkamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityor Ma Hamritangamaya. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Tat Sat.